Channel One Right, and beginning the visit with Debbie, this first session, Thursday morning, the 31st of August, 72. Channel One Right, and beginning the visit with Debbie, this is the first session, Thursday morning, the 31st of August, 72. Channel One Right, and beginning the visit with Debbie, this Thursday morning, the 31st of August, 72.
But when he came the second time, he said there would be, he could tell it's night night, and he quickly made it up there. And he came the second time, and he said, no.
Well, I catch the breath. Let's just sit down, man. Let me get the sand.
Yeah. Ooh. So we had, we really
but she's just allergic to insects.
It's just, well, we didn't know. But he said it depends on where they bite you.
You know, best I didn't see any of these down at I was down at Ocala where I got this last yesterday. And I didn't see any fans. I said to Mr. Stafford, you didn't you throw around? Oh, he says, yeah. We threw them off. Well, I said I haven't seen any around. Oh well, we said we didn't have any this year.
The air conditioner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's another side of it, Debbie. How do you mind all that trash? We just live with trash. I've had such a miserable summer. Of course, miserable. All I've done is work with good artists and stuff.
You're not true with your baby artist?
Well, it's true with me. I can't stand another page. I signed off Monday late, last thing Monday afternoon, Monday night. And Tuesday I celebrated, or at least I went on the rounds to do some errands. I had to see about the old tractor and things down there. And I felt like a fish out of water. I just felt like I wasn't used to this planet. Oh, I'm telling you, it's really good. See, I
you've been working on it all summer.
Oh, yeah, it's just steady.
That's steady.
About the only relief I had was those little letters. Because, and they played out.
And then I get down here and I'm not ever here. That's it. That's the trouble. See, I grew up in Gainesville. I was thinking about that coming out. But, you know, I grew up here, and when I come home, it's, you know, there's so much going on.
Oh,
I just have to move back here to live. That's the only thing. You know, I can't come to visit Gainesville. I don't have time to visit Gainesville. I have to come live here. That's the only way to solve the problem.
Is there just too many?
Yeah, that's just too much going on. I almost been here a whole month, you know, and there's just too much going on. I just have to come live here. That's all. You know, you can't visit Gainesville.
Yeah.
You have to live here.
Well, you'll have to just visit and then immigrate again just to get something done, won't you?
That's about the truth. Well, I thought I might immigrate back up north for the fall, but
yeah.
I don't know after that. I'm still sort of deciding what I'm going to do next.
Yeah.
I was thinking about going back to school, but I don't know whether that's.
Yeah.
I'm still thinking about it.
Well, Debbie, I don't want to. You know.
Oh, I'm open to all suggestions. Anybody can suggest.
No, I don't even want to.
That's.
I can't even discuss it with you because, you know, I don't really, you know, it's shameful when you can't talk about those things, see, but for fear of influences. I remember Roscoe Parker was like that. He said he learned early not to influence people. And he was the dullest person I ever saw. I used to want to be influenced.
And he's no way are.
Yes. And he wouldn't say. No, he'd say, this is nice and the other nice too.
So nice. I don't know if I can count them all. They're a lot. I think, well, part of it is that when I come down, you know, I don't come so often, and there's just an awful lot of people that I see when I come down. And that's, you know, because I lived here for 20 years, and since I was 2 years old, so there are a lot of people that I see. And, well, for example, the man that I saw in Germany is here now, and I want to do some things for him and with him while he's here. Kevin, he was so good to me there, so I need to see him. And,
well, what you going to do with him?
Just talk to him, take him out, you know.
Yeah. You couldn't miss that. That's an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I talked to him so much when I was there, too. I was there for 5 days, and we just went all around together. He's just a wonderful man. He's 78. He just took me everywhere in Germany. He took me, well, around Darmstadt, where he lives in Darmstadt. So we went all around. One day we drove for 12 hours. We started at 8 or 7 in the morning and drove until 7 that night, and he just took me to all... The names are this long. I have a hard time with German. Mickelstadt and... something, Niederbrunnen, something like that. The castle with a moat around it. And he just loves Germany so much, you know, and just told me everything about it. Every little town that we went to had another castle that we had to see. And he told me one time his grandson came over, and he took his grandson to every town to see every castle. And he was there all summer, so they saw a lot of castles. And finally, he said one day, Shaw looked at him and he said, "Fadi, I don't want to see any more darn castles." So every time we'd go to another castle, he'd say, "Debbie, this is another darn castle."
He loved them.
Oh, he loved them. We went to Heidelberg, and he's been to the castle in Heidelberg about 75 times. And we went, the tour to go through that castle is an hour and a half or 2 hours or something like that. It's so mammoth. And we went through the whole thing. I mean, I didn't really care if we went on the tour through the castle. I would have been perfectly happy to sit down in the park outside and just, you know, talk about the castle or something. But no, we had to go through the castle. And we were having a heat wave at that time. It was about 100 degrees.
Oh.
And we walked through this castle up and down stairs like that, you know. But it was fascinating, but it sure was a long tour.
He didn't mind it.
No, he... chugging right along. Right, he was right behind the guide the whole time. He liked the guide, and because he'd been on the tour so much, he could have given the tour himself.
Yeah.
And every time we'd stop in another room, he'd go up and sort of nudge the guide and tell him, "Wasn't it time for a beer yet? Couldn't we stop now?" That's wonderful. Yeah. And then one night he told me his whole life story, all about Hitler and Nazi Germany, and That was, you know, I had sort of mixed reactions about. He was a Nazi, and I had just sort of assumed, I guess, that people in Germany thought that Hitler was sort of an evil man, but they didn't. He said that they just worshipped him. They thought he was the best thing that ever happened to Germany. I was shocked. I guess. I just didn't know very much about Nazi Germany, but he said that before Hitler came in, that Germany was just in an awful state. People riots in the streets all day long, and I guess Hitler established law and order. And so they just let him do anything he wanted to. He even said that they thought it was a good idea to get the Jews out of Germany. although I gather that they didn't, the majority of the German public didn't think that there should be concentration camps and mass slaughter of the Jews, that they thought that the Jews should get out of Germany. Because they were all, I guess, in positions of power and government, and they controlled all the money and everything. And Hitler was trying to lift the German people. And I was fascinated by that. I found it sort of, I guess I had sort of a horrified interest in it, you know, that Hitler was so awful, the whole thing so awful. Mm. But anyway, he's here now because his granddaughter is getting married Saturday. He's working in the yard. Germans are so industrious. He told me that last night. I saw him last night, and we were talking about the difference. He was saying that Europeans just know how to live and take their time with everything, and that's really true.
Yeah.
He said, I spent a year and a half in France, and every night at 4 o'clock, all the French peasants would come out and sit on their doorstep and talk to their goats and have their bottle of wine and just watch life. That's what he was saying. He said, you know, Germans work too hard. They just work too hard. But he's over there. Every day I look across our yard, and he's over in the backyard cleaning up the yard for the wedding this Saturday.
Oh, he's right,
out,
right there.
He's right next door. See, they live next door to us. And he's
No wonder. Gee whiz. She can't come home to visit. She. That's too much going on. And the French peasants got up at 4 o'clock.
In the afternoon.
Oh, that's afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
They quit work.
They quit work and sat down. He was so just so cute. He said they sat down with their goats. They all had their goats. He must have been in the goat breeding district or something of France. I never saw that many goats in France. But he was very influenced by the goats. He said they all had their goats and their bottle of red wine, and they sat on the doorsteps from 4 o'clock on into the night and watched life, so relaxed. He said Germans work too hard, too industrious.
I'd like to see them do that. You see, I could appreciate that now. When I was exposed to those things, I couldn't appreciate it. Yes, I'd love to see that now. Now he meant that was the way it used to be, but it's not that way now.
I didn't see too many French peasants sitting on their doorsteps. They're trying too hard in France to make they're trying to modernize agriculture. They're very concerned because French agriculture is real backward still. There are more people in France are farmers than in any other country in the common market, but they don't produce as much because they all have little farms. They're big farms. It's too bad that all that has to get lost. Sort of like the little grocery stores getting lost too.
Yeah.
The supermarket. So I don't know what the solution is either. How you keep. Because they want to be financially successful.
Now that loaf of bread that you wrote about in your letter, the Americans have to be so hygienic.
Wrap everything up in paper. go into a Minute Mart and look. There's nothing that isn't wrapped in cellophane.
Yeah.
We live in a plastic society.
Yeah, we're little individuals.
I mean,
where you see that piece of candy bar.
And nothing in Europe is, well, not yet. In the supermarkets, it is. Supermarkets, they wrap everything up. But the little stores, they don't. Things
they don't
just
wrap
sit out. And at the end of the day, if they haven't sold it, they just sort of give it away because they get fresh produce every day. And they get everything fresh. That's why it's so good.
But you didn't do any of the shopping.
I did. When Phoebe and I, when I was traveling with Phoebe, we used to go shopping a lot. We'd get picnics, and when she'd go off painting, we'd have picnics in the car and stuff, so we shopped then. But I didn't have too much to do with it when I was living with the UNLs, because they had a they didn't want me to help in the house at all. They thought that since I was paying room and board that I shouldn't have anything to do with, I guess it's the European idea of the servant or something. They thought that I would think that they were taking advantage of me or something if I helped in the kitchen. Well, I wanted to. I thought it would be fun. I wanted to do cooking in the kitchen and, you know, learn how to do things. I wanted to learn how to make mayonnaise, and they didn't want me to do anything. That used to be a big bone of contention, that I was an au pair because I used to do so much. And I didn't do anything. I set the table at night or something. And Madame Yunal told me that I was I did more than any au pair girl she ever had. Said, I have a paying au pair. What am I going to do? So I couldn't do anything. They wouldn't let me. They thought I'd think I was being a servant. That's an old part of Europe that I guess is just sort of part of their heritage still. Yeah. Servants.
Now, you didn't get out of that.
Out of?
That part of Europe.
Which?
The one you're talking about. That heritage business. You were in heritage all the time.
Yes.
So you that's the only Europe you saw. I just asked you. I'm not trying to trip you or anything. I just asked you.
That's what I was thinking about mostly, I guess, because, well, the Yunals live, they're very upper class people. They live in a fabulous villa, and they had a sailboat.
Oh, they do?
Yes.
Well, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yes. I lived on Cap Ferrat, which is this jet set peninsula off Nice, about 30 minutes outside of Nice, and that's where all the movie stars have their villas.
But you know, had a villa.
Yes, I lived in their villa. They had a huge villa. They had a yacht, which they proceeded to wreck during the course of the summer because they didn't know how to sail, and they just went out and bought this yacht. And the Judy now decided that he wanted to be a sailor, so he went and took 6 sailing lessons and bought a yacht. He didn't know how to sail, and so he went out. They used to go out sailing every couple of weeks. And he went out one Sunday with his wife and his child, and they got caught in a windstorm, and they were heading straight for the rocks. Well, all he had to do was drop anchor. And no, he thought he could maneuver around the rocks, and he put the boat right on the rocks and destroyed it. And so they had to have the whole hull rebuilt. I thought he probably should have... Well, Madame Yunal said she was going to go take sailing lessons after that. But that's sort of like buying a horse after you've ridden one 6 times.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. There's no sense in it if you don't know what you're doing. I mean, it seems to me it's a waste of money until you should know a little bit more what you're doing before you go and spend money like that.
But
and I... Pardon?
Is he a banker or something?
No, he runs a construction company.
Yeah.
They build ports. And there's a lot of money in that in Nice or around on the Riviera. Because a lot of people go out and buy yachts when they had 6 sailing lessons. Oh, dear. So, and I wrote you about his watering system. That used to be he'd come home every night and we'd have to go check on the watering system, see if it was watering at the right time.
Oh, it even had a thermostat.
You set it and it would go on and off at the right time. Now, see, this is that's a world that I never... I'm sure there are people like that here, but I've never lived in a world like that before. I mean, I suppose it's Kirkwood or something in Gainesville is like that. I don't know. But actually, the Yunals were, most of the people that lived on Cap Ferrat just had sort of summer villas there. The people, Otto Preminger had a summer villa there, and Ray Milland, and people like that, and the Yunals were one of the few families that actually lived there.
Tell him to come on and rest a minute, and then we'll go ahead with what we're doing.
Yeah.
Well, I will tell you, Debbie.
Well, I was looking for the heritage all the time in things, because their life was very modern. So I was looking for little things like the servant.
You weren't
attitude.
Looking for the modern. You were looking for
no.
The heritage.
I don't...
Over here.
Oh, Rick, here's a good place.
All right.
You know he sits over there at the Wiggles. He got those Miami shoes.
What kind of shoes do you have, Rick?
They're not broken in. They haven't been broken in.
Wait, I can't.
They haven't been wearing really cowboy
boots. Oh, cowboy boots.
They still look college. You can't make them look country.
Not broken in.
Well, have you washed them?
Well, you know, I somehow had the idea that Mr., you know, was maybe the head of some little dinky office somewhere.
I did too, Debbie.
And sort of flat-headed.
Well, no, he was a big executive. Very, just sort of the archetypal Frenchman. Anything French was good, and anything that wasn't French was bad. He was a Gaullist, and a gourmet. I mean, you can't be French and not be a gourmet. I told you, he used to give me lectures about the butter. What kind of butter we were eating, what kind of honey. We'd go down for breakfast and we'd have a different kind of honey, and he'd give me a lecture on the honey and why American honey is bad. Because we don't let it age properly. Honey's no good unless it's aged.
What constitutes age?
It gets solid. You can't have honey when it's liquid.
6 months?
6 months probably, yeah. Just let it sit. Yeah, have you ever bought comb honey?
Yeah.
And let it sit around for a long time?
No.
It crystallizes. And that's the way they eat honey in France. They let it sit till it gets solid. I had some honey like that once. I got it. I kept it a year. It turned into a block of sugar. But see, now that would have been just right in France. I thought it was not too good to eat. I mean, I didn't think it would kill me or anything if I ate it, but I wasn't used to eating solid honey.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't eat runny honey. It's got to be hard. But see, there are different kinds of honey, too. Depends on what the bees.
Sure.
Well, that makes sense. Depends on what the bees.
Do they feed the bees, or they depend on the neighborhood?
I never saw any beehives in France. I did in Germany.
Oh, I see.
And there they.
Oh, of course. He didn't raise his.
No, he went out and bought it.
He
didn't raise it. No. And every year they'd go out and buy flowers for the beds. You know, I don't know why they went and got different flowers every year. There must have been some kind of flower that they could plant that wouldn't die, but they would buy hundreds and hundreds of flowers to go around the house every spring.
Yeah.
For the garden.
Well,
and plant them.
What would you do? Just put the seed in?
No, they were plants. Blooming already.
I understand, but what would you do?
Oh, if it were my garden?
Yeah.
I'd have something that I didn't have to plant every year.
Oh, you'd just put it in perennials and
mm-hmm.
shrubs.
Not shrubs. Well, they could bloom. That's all right, but I... I just thought buying 75 blooming plants
yeah.
every spring was sort of, I don't know, a way.
Let me tell you, I thought I was fairly well acquainted with you now, and it's all wrong.
That's right, me too. I don't know what I imagined the house was like, but I certainly didn't think of it as being a villa, and that this was a, you know.
You mean it was a big thing?
Oh, it had marble floors and marble stairs.
Ooh.
And...
Yeah.
It was huge. It was three times the size of our house. Enormous.
Marble stairs.
Uh-huh. Marble floors. They had everything in the kitchen too. I mean, that they had a very modern kitchen for France. They had a washing machine and a dryer and everything. But it was really funny. She had a washing machine. This is heritage coming through. She had a washing machine, but it was little. The washing machines in France are about this big. And she washed all their clothes in the bathtub. She didn't wash them in the washing machine. She washed sheets in the washing machine, but she washed all their clothes in the bathtub.
Leaning over?
Mm-hmm. Rubbing them. Which I thought was, I mean... That,
Madame Minon?
Mm-hmm.
No, the maid.
No, Madame Minon used to do it. She only had a maid 3 days a week, so...
Yeah. Did she have to serve the maid tea?
The maid didn't drink tea.
In England, the maids had tea, and they had to be served.
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes, they didn't want to sit down and serve themselves. They just sit down and let the lady serve them.
Where did you see that?
Were
you in London?
Huh.
Hmm.
Well, it's been some time. I can't give you the circumstances, but if I thought about it, it'd come back to me. And, you see, I saw you've seen this so much more than I ever did. Because the only place I was ever at was a little village of Boomstorf, and the other one, a little grapefruit thing. One outside of Hanover, and the other outside of Munich. And you see, the only other place I went, I took the trolley, or the interurban, whatever you call it, into town. About 15 minutes, and I didn't stop anywhere. And that's all I ever saw. You know?
No.
You're Richard Halliburton compared to me.
Well, there's a lot to see.
Well, now, was this on the Riviera?
Yes, it was.
And you could see the...
The water was
what?
10 minutes away walking.
You know, she may be a traveler, friend.
I think he's going to be a Frenchman.
Well, let me tell you. I wasn't quipping.
No, not either.
I meant she knows how to see things.
Yeah.
She can move around.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did. I know I'd see anything. Except that's right down the village. Of course, I've had all those loaves of bread, you see, put them on your arm and cut off. I don't see how you could just tear yourself away from the territory, Debbie.
Well, it wasn't. I liked them. They were very nice people, but I didn't particularly care too much for the life there. And then the Riviera life is not, you know, it's sort of like Miami Beach.
Oh.
You know, they're great big hotels. Except that all the great big hotels that were built on the Riviera were built for Queen Victoria. She used to come down and go into all these huge monstrous hotels. But they're interesting because they're Victorian sort of. The Negresco, which is the biggest hotel in Nice, has got all these turrets and things. It's fantastic to see, and they have little guards with livery that come out and put you into your car and everything. But that's only interesting to go look at once. You know, it's not. Nice is a big tourist city. It's where all of Europe goes to go swimming, and they do too. You can't move on the beach in the summertime. So I was very anxious to get out of Nice, especially in June. Which is when people start coming to Nice. In the wintertime, it's a little better because it's cold, and it's only people who are rich enough to afford furs that come to Nice in the wintertime. Yeah, you can only count poodles and fur coats for so long.
You had you planned on this foray down into Corsica?
Yes, I planned to go to Corsica. I wanted to see it, and it was close to Nice. So you take the boat. We went steerage on the boat over and back to Marseille. About 7 hours in the boat.
And back.
Mm-hmm.
One way.
One way, I'm sorry. Well, it's 7 hours from Nice to Corsica, and then it's 12 to Marseille. Even farther.
But just pleasant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting. We came back. I convinced my friend that we should go steerage class. Because I was used to going on boats in Greece, and you always go steerage class on the boats in Greece. And so I booked a steerage class to come back overnight. And I convinced her that it was really going to be all right, that, you know, we'd have to sleep on the deck, but it would be all right. So we went to get on the boat at 7 o'clock at night, and there must have been about 200 Algerian laborers who were coming from Algeria to Marseille. And that was all that was going in steerage class. And us. So my friend looked at me and she said, "Oh, we're going with the Algerian dopes, Martha." I mean, they were perfectly nice. They looked like Algerian dope smugglers, but they weren't. They were just laborers coming over to Marseille to work in all the factories, you know.
And they'd take
it out of you. Oh, well, we were afraid they would. There were the knives coming out. But we had a pleasant enough. Well, actually, there were four females in steerage. my friend and I, and then two of the workers were bringing their families over. So there were about 10 little tiny children and their wives were there.
So the children protected you.
Yeah, we figured the children protected us. It didn't bother me, but I think my friend was a little horrified.
Why'd you get the idea of going to steerage?
From Greece. Because when I was in Greece, we used to go around to all the islands, and we'd always go on the deck, which is steerage class. It's much nicer. And the trips aren't long. It's 4 hours or something from island to island. And so you just sit on the deck and have a nice time. And I guess I just didn't think that, you know, overnight 12 hours on the deck would might
be
a little different.
You got on seven at night.
Yes, and got to Marseille at 7 the next morning.
So you just slept steerage is all.
Yes. We didn't see anything. Well, we rented little chairs and sat in the chairs all night. I was so surprised because my friend is from New York, and she loves New York, and you couldn't pay me money to live in New York City. That place just scares me to death. And here she was so disturbed by riding deck class from Corsica to Marseille. You know, she wanted to sleep and shift. She said, "Well, Debbie, I'll sleep from 12 to 1, and you can sleep from 1 to 2, and it won't keep waking each other up all night." I said, "Russell, and just calm down and go to sleep. Nothing's going to happen to you." That's funny. Corsica was just marvelous. I had the feeling that I should thank everybody. Everywhere we went, they were so nice to us. You know, in the hotels or anywhere. And when we went to a little fishing village to stay for a couple of days, and people were just always doing things for us. You know, they'd stop and pick us up on the roads to give us rides because we didn't have a car. We nearly killed ourselves going down the mountain. It was 4 kilometers straight down, like that, to the beach.
Well, had the mockingbirds fighting today.
Mm-hmm. Came up against
it. Yes,
what? Just flew up against the window. I thought it might have hurt itself.
From the hotel, it was what?
4 kilometers. Well, I asked the woman who ran the hotel. I said, "We've come to go to the beach." And she said, "Oh, isn't that nice?" And I said, "Where is the beach?" And she said, "Well, it's down there." And I said, "How far is it?" And she said, "It's 4 kilometers." Well, I'm not very mathematical, and I never in 7 months was able to convert from kilometers to miles. I just always assumed that a kilometer was just this tiny fraction of a mile. You know, it wasn't really a mile, and so I said, "Oh, that's nice." And she looked at me sort of strangely, and she said, "Do you have a car?" And I said, "No, we're going to walk." "We're going to walk?" And I think she sort of went, you know, "Oh, my God." So we started out. It took us an hour and a half to walk down the mountain because the road went like this down the mountain. And Russ kept saying, "Well, why don't we just climb between the hairpin turns, just climb down."
Yeah,
and I said, "Well, go right ahead. It's a mountain." So we got down, and we figured that since it took us an hour and a half to get down, it would take us at least 4 hours to get back up again. Meanwhile, we could hardly walk because it's harder to walk downhill than uphill.
Uh-huh.
Much harder. This was supposed to be, you know, rest by the sea. And we got a ride back up. We spotted some people on the beach that lived at our hotel.
You fudged.
Of course. We not only fudged, we planned. We saw them there. Went up and introduced ourselves and said, you know, "Hi, we're staying at your hotel. Don't you want to give us a ride back?" And they said, "Oh, of course, but we're going kayaking now." And so we said, "Well, fine." And it started to rain, and we thought, "Oh, well, they'll never go kayaking in the rain," but they did. And so we sat down and waited in the rain until they came back, which was about an hour later, because we just couldn't face walking up that hill. And then the next day, we started walking down, and they came down the hill as we were walking down and gave us a ride down, and then they disappeared. They wised up to us, and they disappeared. And so we decided we'd start walking back up the hill. And we walked about 5 minutes, and it was about 100 degrees. And we just sat down by the side of the road and waited till somebody came by, and they gave us a ride up the hill. But people are just nice like that in Corsica.
Well, now, you didn't see the little donkey right there around those big hotels.
Donkey.
Remember the little burra that you saw?
And you wrote a sign. It was in Corsica.
I can't tell you the circumstances, but you were impressed with this little burra, donkey. That's the last thing you said in the letter. I may have a little thing there somewhere.
You might be faced with what you said.
Well, you don't remember it.
Yeah, I don't remember the
burrow. You don't remember that burrow?
That one. There was there were donkeys all around because
They're
beasts of burden there.
Yeah.
They used them to carry firewood and...
So they'd have them all around
They were certainly all around the village.
Yes.
They were all around the hotel because it wasn't a big grand hotel. It was a little pension. There were two in the town, and we stayed in the one that was right in the middle of town, so there were probably donkeys around.
Did you stay in the little hotel?
Yes.
It was a pension?
Yes, it was a hotel. They had rooms, and then you had all your meals there, too, because there was no place else to eat
in
the town.
So, you'd all eat together or separately?
All together. Everyone, we were supposed to eat at 7:30, I think, and so everyone would be so hungry by about 7, they'd start congregating downstairs, and the little lady that ran the hotel, she did everything. She waited on the tables, just did everything, and she would start setting the tables, and she'd start going by these hungry people, the hordes would just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, you know? And finally, about 7:45, after we'd all been sort of sitting there like this for half an hour, she'd say it was time to eat, and then we'd all go in and eat. Together. We all had our own little tables. You know.
Oh, did you?
And they'd save your napkins.
Not at one big table?
No. Yeah, everyone had a little table. It was a little room. The room was probably about the size of the kitchen. You know. Maybe a little bigger, yeah.
Well, what I was thinking of, out there you'd see everybody.
Yes.
And then your little tables, you can still talk to other people.
Mm-hmm. But people don't really do that so much. When you're sitting at your separate tables, you sit at your separate table.
And just talk to
you. You nod to people when you go in, you know, but it's just sort of proper about staying at your table.
And talking to your own.
And you talk to the person that's sitting across from you. It's French privacy.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Don't really. You don't carry on conversations in the whole room.
Well, how'd you understand? Where'd you learn that?
Well, that's what everyone was doing.
I see.
That's what we did.
So you just saw what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And did what they were doing.
But Corsica is so different from me.
Yes. Very different. It's very unspoiled. That's what's so nice about it. And Monsieur now told me that he thought it would stay that way because, well, the French people don't like the Corsicans very much because when Corsicans come to France, they always sort of stay in groups and they isolate themselves from the French, which is sort of because they have kind of an island mentality. You know, they've always been sort of an oppressed people, and they always feel like they're on an island, even, I guess, when they come to France. And so Monsieur Unel said that because of this, they really love their land, and they won't sell it when all the developers come in and they try to buy the land from them to put up big hotels, and they won't sell all the little Corsican farmers.
Right.
So he thinks it will remain fairly unspoiled for a long time. There's no way to get around. There are about two roads, and takes you a day to get from one end of the island to the other because the roads are so bad. It took us 4 hours to go about this far on the map. We took there's one bus a day from Ajaccio to Piana, and it took us 4 hours. The bus went about 25 miles an hour around these little tiny, tiny turns in the road.
Yeah.
So it's...
And you talk to the people on the bus. Or at least you
listen to them talk. See, my friend didn't speak French, so I'd translate for her. She didn't speak French. And she understood a little bit, but not too much.
Yeah.
So it makes it hard.
I guess I thought Corsica was sort of a base of the mafia, something like that.
That's
well,
Sicily.
I know.
It's not.
Yes. Well, now, you got off into the hinterland, you might say.
Yes.
Away from the big hotel.
Yes, well, in Ajaccio, we didn't stay in a big hotel. We stayed in a nunnery. Did I tell you
about
that?
Oh,
she's
the one who gave you the key to get back in.
Mm-hmm.
I'd forgotten. How was that?
Well, when I wanted to go there, the UNALF told me that they had big luxury hotels, or you camped, and they wanted us to camp. They were going to lend us a tent and everything, and we decided not to because we wanted to go to Marseille, not to back to Nice. So I had a friend who was living in a girls' dorm run by a Catholic school in Nice, and she said, "There's a Catholic school in Ajaccio. Why don't you go stay there?" So I wrote them a letter and asked them if I could. And my friend told me that they have sort of little cells, little narrow little rooms with one bed, so I thought I'd have to have two beds. So I asked them if they had two rooms with a bed in each room, and the nun got very upset, and she called me and said that they had a room, but there were two beds in the room, and she didn't know if we could do that, if we'd accept this room with two beds in it. So she called the other convent and talked to them, and so the nun and niece decided that she would have a good time with her, and so she said, "Well, you know, these girls are Americans, they're rich Americans, and they're used to having things really nice, and you just better be careful when they get there." This poor nun was so distressed because we were staying in the infirmary. They only had one extra room, and it was where they put the girls when they were sick, and She was very nice to us. She really was. And we stayed there.
That sounds like the old Italian bishop of the monastery. I guess it's a monastery in the back part of China. I was at Little Ashtip at Hanshan, I don't know, several months. And there was this big Italian establishment, you see, it had been there. He was elderly, and he was a spirited man if I ever saw one. The bishop himself, he was the one. Whenever he came around, you see, things just picked up. And I can't just tell you the things he did, but he talked, always got into everything that was going on. And one of his failings was, you see, here we were little humble GIs. We spoke English and didn't speak that very well. And he spoke all these languages, and he didn't know whether he was speaking Chinese or Greek or Italian. He just, you see, he'd go from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell when he'd shift, but I didn't know which one. So, yes, and I remember one of the little... one of the lay brothers, and I don't know how I learned this, because I didn't speak Italian or Chinese, but I must have seen him. No, I couldn't have seen him, because it was night. But, you see, they had trouble with insects, just like we do, and they didn't have sprays. And at night, he'd put that little lamp over in front of him, get a tub of water, and take his, they just had one roll, one for summer and one for winter, you know how that is. At least they didn't have many changes. That's what they said. I don't know what they had, actually. And you see, he'd go down the seams and open that up to the light, and the fleas would jump down in the water.
Because of the light.
Yes. And that's the way they kept protected themselves.
That's a new place to do that.
And it was a huge old compound. I can't quite see the house now. I haven't looked at it in so long, but I can see the grape arbor. You had, you know, the compounds had the little walls around them. And I never knew whether those compounds were European or Asian. The people I ran across in Asia never seemed to have any feeling for privacy. They'd walk, two of my friends that spoke English, I'd walk down the street with them, and her, she was important. Her daddy was a warlord, one of the old warlords, and she'd walk down the street, the crowded streets, and the coolies would come along and just hunt her off. And she never even looked, cut her eyes back at them, you see. And they were used to that. So, they had all these, they must have had them, somebody else too. But they just had, but you know, one grapevine will, you know, if you, if it's productive, you see, your grapevine can have its roots here, and then it can go clear around the countryside. You know that, 100 feet, 200 feet, the grapevine? And you see, they trim it back so that it just has those little sprigs. That bad grapes have three or four bunches on a sprig, and they got all those sprigs just thick, you see, all down that long grapevine. And they raise enough on one grapevine to last them. You see, they've got to have a little wine with the meals. Italians, I got the idea they did. But see, I didn't see much. I wasn't like Debbie, you see. Seemed like I'd just go, I don't know what I looked at when I was there.
I would like to stay at a nunnery.
But that world is so various, isn't it?
Nuns like, really are saintly. You saying they really are. They're just sort of, they glide sort of, and just in robes, and they were always coming up to us and saying, "How are you today, dear?" And they're just really saintly people. Maybe it's just Corsican nuns are like that. They're the only nuns I've ever known. That's right.
On a little bus. And understanding what they all said.
That's all of them.
And you paid.
Yes. at the nunnery, we gave them $1 a night for the infirmary. And then we had to pay for our meals and everything in the village. We paid them more. Yeah. $5, I think.
But you could. There were places to eat in the village.
No.
Oh, I see.
You had to. Well, there was the restaurant in the hotel, and that was the only place to eat.
Yeah.
So there was. Well, I think there was a cafe where you could get coffee, but there was no other restaurant.
But at the nunnery, you ate at the nunnery?
No, we ate in Ajaccio.
I see.
Yeah. They let us have breakfast in the morning there, yeah, but we didn't eat with them. But the village just had two streets. It had a crossroads, some camp, that's all. And a church. And a road to the beach.
By that time, you had been around so much. Didn't you ever get tired?
I hadn't really been around that much. I was in Nice for almost 4 months.
Yeah, that's not what I mean. But you'd been looking around and everything since Christmas. You got over there at Christmas.
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't get tired. Not tiring.
And up there in northern France, you were looking at everything too there for a couple of months, weren't you?
Well, the first part of February. And then I went back and I spent about 3 weeks there, I guess, in the summer.
Well, now, I thought I'd remember the statement you made that you had been living architecture for a while. So
that was in Italy, too. All of February, we went, up into northern France, and then we went from there straight back to Italy, to Florence, and all around Florence. And that was just wonderful.
And you were with Fida then?
I was with Fida then, who's my godmother, who's an artist, who also loves the Italian Renaissance. And I just was ecstatic of just to go into any church with her and see any little old church that you go into around Florence has got frescoes by Giotto on the wall, or Piero della Francesca, or someone like that. And I knew what their names were because I took one course in art history in college, and I used to write home about how wonderful the art was, and my father now thinks that I should go back and get a master's in art history. That's what I should do. And so I said, well, Dad, I've only taken one course in art history, but I bet I know more about the Italian Renaissance art and the different schools, the Florentine school, the Sienese school, because of going with Phoebe.
Oh, yes.
And seeing all the things that she saw.
Oh, gee,
and just
well,
listening to her talk when we'd go in and look at 500 Duccios in Siena, and you'd think that'd be boring, but it's not.
No.
Especially when you go with an artist.
Yeah.
He talks about it, and you see what's different. I mean, he did paint 500 Madonnas and Madonna and Child, but you can see how his style changed and what he learned looking at that many. And the thing that I think is so wonderful about the early Renaissance in Italy is that they really meant what they were painting. There was none. They were very sincere, religious people, and they meant it when they painted Madonnas and children. And
yes.
And that was lost very quickly.
Yes.
People got in the 17th, 18th century. They didn't mean it. They were just painting pretty pictures. There was no religion behind it at all. And you feel that they're honest. They didn't know very much about painting, but they were very honest people. What they were trying to do.
In the 17th
century? No, in the Renaissance, in the 14th and 15th century.
I don't know anything about those. I wish I did. But now up in the cathedral section.
Oh. I had a love affair with the stained glass. I think stained glass art is marvelous. I went to every cathedral I could go to.
Yeah.
I've seen 15 or 20. Every time we'd see a church, we'd stop and go into it, because that's where all the art was in the Middle Ages, was in the churches.
Yeah.
And the stained glass they've never been able to do it again since the 12th century. They've never been able to reproduce the glass or the colors. And it's just, I just have this feeling when I'm standing and looking at it that this is something that you'll never see anywhere else in the world, and it's so easily destroyed. I mean, you're sort of struck with the frailty of human endeavor, because you could throw a rock at it and destroy it.
Yeah.
And in fact, most of it has been destroyed all over France.
Yeah.
You were with C.D.
Yes,
you
so we went to
that with her.
To Chartres together, and that's where all the glass is left. The other cathedrals sometimes have two or three windows that haven't been destroyed, but Chartres has all of them, just about. And they're really beautiful.
And it was the glass. Yeah.
And there again, too, it was the honesty of the whole community building the church. The windows were given by the guilds, and nobody signed the windows. They don't know who did them. They know which guild donated the window, but they don't know which artist painted which face.
Yeah.
That was even earlier than the Italian work.
Yeah. That's a mentality is hard to.
It's hard to comprehend today.
Comprehend.
Yes, because it could never happen now.
Have you read Ruskin on any of that?
No.
Well, let me tell you, I read Henry Adams, you know, but I didn't know much about it. I read it to the degree. But Ruskin I've never read. Now, Henry Adams was going to do it, but Ruskin is the one, as I understand it, as I remember it, as I picked up somewhere along the line, Ruskin is the one who associates the economic system with the arts system. And yes, you know, that's one of the hardships of the academic life. People who know things won't talk about it. They see what we're doing here isn't done anywhere I go. This is the only place. I see people going everywhere, but I don't learn anything from them.
You just said they had a good time.
Yeah. I've known people who who knew Ruskin, but they never told me anything about him. Well, they say, well, you go read him. Yes, but it's difficult, you see, to read someone like that. Suppose I read him, I read the words, but I still don't know what he's doing quite. You have to live with it so long. You know those things. This business of, you see, the people I finally worked with out here, you see, what I call the countryside. There's no word for those things. You can't say people are uneducated or educated now, or that they're country people and town people. You see, those distinctions are all gone. I just use countryside because no one uses it. And I could use Houseman's, what's he calling it? The shops I'll add, you see, but that doesn't, the shops I'll add, say, I call them, well, that might fit Mr. Weaver, he's pretty bald, and some of them. But, you see, they have, all their life is public.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean when they go to the toilet, you see, you can make it extreme. But I mean anything they do talk about. Now, Miss Guthrie, you see, she had this, she adopted this boy, and he was a pain in the neck. He got in all sorts of trouble. And there, for the last few years, he was an invalid, and his bones wouldn't hold together, and he married this woman who was a prostitute and worse, and she finally shot him, and the police don't give a damn. Just so it's not their business, unless it's somebody in the family to do it. She'll talk about that in great detail, circumstantially. I mean, she looks at it. It's not a skeleton. It's she got no labels for it. Well, now Phyllis Elsham, we went here. They were feeding there, came out to feed the filling. We were just sitting here just a minute. We haven't been able to sit in the kitchen. It's been so humid. Have to get out of there. And came out. And she was brought up in a little old country restaurant up there in the Middle West. And the family that owned it just turned it over to her on the weekend, and they did something else. She kept track of everything, and she said she'd still be doing that. But the old country doctor used to come in there and get coffee, and he'd say to her, you can't just do this all your life. And he kept after her, and she wanted something. But you know, she wouldn't give it, you know, where you, she just mm-hmm. touched it and went on. Well, I don't know. Guess that's in it. I just thought you don't know what the medieval attitude is. You call it anonymous, but you don't really know that mentality, and it's impossible to reconstruct it. I think it's just an abstraction, really.
Mm-hmm.
But this business for these people, you see, and I when I'm with them, you see, I do the same thing. And then when I go up to the office, I'm hemmed in. I have to think always on the good behavior. And if I'm not the hell they want you to talk about?
True.
But now that, you see, that Gothic, I've been to a cathedral too, but I never had a feel for it such as you had, and the high point of it for you was those windows.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The glass.
The subjects in the windows, mm-hmm. and the carts and things.
Oh, you just, you have, you know, you come out knowing, knowing so much more about biblical literature. You just have to, and it's not even just biblical literature. It's all the ways that they mixed everything up. They wouldn't get the story straight from the Old Testament or the New Testament. They'd throw in a couple of extra home saints and things like that. And it's just fascinating to read the windows. I mean, I'd rather sit and read the windows than read just about anything else right now. It's fascinating. But see, when you're reading the windows, you're also reading the New Testament. And the different ways that people interpret the windows. But I listened to one man talk about them, and he said that Henry Adams had an Oedipus complex in Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres, because all he talked about was Mary. And he said that's not right, and you know, everybody's got a different idea, I guess. And Henry Adams said that the big windows, the 12th century windows, the biggest ones, are all dedicated to Mary, and they did it all to be beautiful for Mary. And this man said that no, it's really all for Christ, that Mary is really just the mother of Christ. You know.
What does it matter? It's the view of the windows.
No, it doesn't matter. It's just,
you can look at it either way.
You can look at it either way.
Yeah.
Mary's up on top of the window, so you can either say, well, they put, but see, you don't know, because you don't know what the medieval, you don't know what the community was, why they really did it. I think Henry Adams does love Mary an awful lot. That's all he talks about. He waxes eloquent on how they made the cathedral entirely for Mary, and I think he got a little carried away, but that's the way he reacted to it.
And there's no suffering. There's no suffering in charge. There's no cross.
Yes.
Well, this rests me, Faye.
But just imagine going to Chartres with Phoebe.
Yeah.
And she went around painting and taking pictures. You know, she spent the, well, she had to take a lot of pictures because it was so cold. Oh, it was cold. We were there in February.
Oh, that's right.
Because we put on every piece of clothing we had, and it was still cold.
Yeah.
That's when we went around and stood over the heaters. You'd see the people going around the church, and then they'd end up on the heater. The only place that was warm. This place are human.
But I'm telling you, they can even be chilly in summer.
Yes.
You get cool summers way up there, you see. And those old pavements really hold the cold, don't they?
And the stone.
Yeah, stone. They built with stone. I mean, they use stone so much.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Phoebe was interested in painting, too, while she was there.
Yes, it was a painting trip for her. She wanted to paint, but it was so cold, and we went at the wrong time of year, really, for her to paint, because she couldn't paint outside. It was too cold. She can't wear gloves when she paints, and her hands would get too cold with water, the watercolor.
Well, now, her grant, I mean, she went for a... This was a sort of a business with you all to start with.
I
never quite understood it.
No, well, we had thought she wanted to give a lecture. We prepared a lecture last fall on the teaching figures, how to paint figures in watercolor. And that's what I had been working on last fall with her. And she had wanted to give this lecture in the different schools where we went, and no one would take it. So she said, well, we'll just go and have it be a painting trip instead. She painted.
She wanted to give a lecture.
too. We had it translated into French.
Yeah.
And recorded in French. It was a taped lecture and slides that went along with it.
Yeah.
And she wanted to go just to art schools around France and give this lecture.
Yeah.
So that she could both meet other artists and, you know, share her ideas about teaching watercolor. But there was actually quite a large art school in Nice, but they were so tied up in their bureaucratic snarls that they never did anything about having her come.
Yeah.
They had fired the person who was in charge of. They had to have a separate person to take care of international lectures or something like that. It's just incredible. French bureaucracy is incredible. They have so many people to do so many little tiny jobs, and if that person isn't there, the job doesn't get done. And everyone accepts it, and things.
Now that's been going on in France for a century.
Of course, they can't live any other way. If things were efficient, they wouldn't know what to do.
Has that been going on since Napoleon?
Well, he's the one that. Yes, I guess so, because he set up the structure of French government,
yes,
as it is today. So
yes,
it's the Code Napoleon, and
it's just been refined on.
Yeah, they've really worked to get 75 people working in the post offices. They probably have one person to sort the letters that are going to the north of France, and one person to sort the letters that are. They and strikes in France are incredible. When we were visiting our friends in Nevers, her husband came home at 10 o'clock in the morning. We said, "Well, what's wrong? Why are you here?" And he said, "We're on strike for 2 hours." They just
2 hours.
They were on strike from 10 to 12. And then he went back after that. They don't go on strike and everybody walks out. They go on strike for an hour and a half or 2 hours. Or the people that sort the mail for Corsica go on strike, but everybody else doesn't. They think that they're disrupting service. They're not really stopping it. They're just disrupting it. And the buses used to go on strike in Nice. But they didn't really go on strike. They would just run every third bus so that 40% of the people wouldn't get to work on time.
Why, Debbie?
You just have to understand strikes in France. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. They're always on strike, but it doesn't mean what it means in this country. When someone goes on strike in this country, they walk out and everything stops, but that's not true in France. They're always on strike.
There was awful longshoremen strikes, you know, in this country, the Kyle reports, and in England, like they had.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that leave all the vegetables to perish.
But now in France, if the longshoremen went on strike, probably they go on strike in shifts or something for 5 hour stretches.
And just disrupted, not stopped.
Just disrupt, not cause they're anarchistic.
So it's always
just want to create a little chaos along the way.
Always in that state.
Mm-hmm. Someone's always on strike in France. They had a postal strike every week that I was there. 7 months. Somebody was on the ride.
How do you get along? You saw so much of it. How do you get along now without getting a little dose of that every day? You don't even have a French paper or a paper that has French.
I haven't even spoken any French since I've come back.
Well, talk to us a little bit in French. Just start right out, right now.
Oh, you don't have to do that. You talk French. She loves to talk French. You got no way of dipping into it now.
No.
You don't get any of the newspapers. Would the newspapers help you?
The good newspapers that had something to say were pretty difficult French. And the Nice paper was just a scandal sheet. They have two kinds of press, two kinds of journalism in France. They have all the scandal sheets and the François, which is, you know, who's done who Jackie Onassis is running off with this weekend, that sort of thing. And then the other papers were, the French was very difficult for me because it's...
Let me tell you, that's one of the great surprises to me. I never did get so I could read newspaper in German. Those articles were hefty. I'd study them with a dictionary and still didn't know what they said. Of course, I was young and I didn't... wasn't really interested. I could probably manage them now, you know, with a dictionary. I don't know.
you ought to get to the library where Le Monde or something is around. Mm-hmm.
Well, you illustrated
Illustrated
Statement. Your illustrated magazines. They were good.
They were a lot of pictures.
Like mine.
Yeah, in French. They and all their magazines are modeled after American magazines, too. If you open L'Exprès, which is the, like Time, it's the very same format as Time.
Oh.
They even place the pictures in the same place on the page, and they have the same layout.
Oh.
It's just like Time magazine.
Do you have a company?
No.
You don't have one?
I don't.
I wish I could see one. See, I never learned anything like that. Gee whiz, right? We ought to get Debbie to give us a little short course.
Yeah.
You know, like the cattlemen have, where they have a couple of days short course.
Short course in French.
Have a few.
Maybe to get us an assignment to go around giving short courses. I mean, that's right. I mean, you do have a lot to say, Debbie.
I didn't talk about me. I don't talk about anybody else. You know, I have always been just had a huge appetite to see what goes on, see things. And you see, I couldn't find out. And nobody would tell me. I didn't have the keys. Well, now you see, I know how now. I can do it better than a journalist. I can find out, and I also know how to set it down. But I'm fast traveling. I sort of tied down to the corner of Rice County. But the thing of it is, I see enough here to interest me. It'll do me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wish I could see more here. But even so, you see, there's all that other stuff. Debbie knows it, has got a hand in so much. Gosh, you see.
That's my
now
problem,
see,
right now.
And if they write, if they were right, if the nuns from Corsica would write to her. But you see, they can't write. And if they write, they wouldn't write what you want to know.
Just what you see on that one little island of Corsica.
Yeah.
For the nuns.
Just all those places where you attend. Wouldn't that be nice? You can't telephone.
No. You'd never make it through the French telephones even if you wanted to.
Yeah. I've got to go out and run an errand too. I just hate to leave. Gee whiz, it's so nice.
Well, it spoils you, doesn't it? Living in,
yeah,
in France. It does.
Well, in some ways. Yeah, but I'm not too spoiled.
Well, Debbie, how much more time do you need to spend on French to get control of it? You said in your letter that you love to speak it, you know. And I assume that you spoke it and you could handle it, but you... Still,
right. I haven't read very much in French.
Yes.
That's, you know, my command of the language would be a lot better if I'd read a lot more in French.
Yes.
You know, I can read just about anything. I don't have trouble reading, but I haven't read that much.
Yeah.
We didn't study literature.
Well, what I ran across was a German, young, my age in school. I went to listen to some of the lectures at the University of Munich, and I found there that they spoke English. They'd go and spend 2 or 3 months in London and come back and they'd speak English as well as I did. But it was based on all that reading. There's huge amounts of reading, you see, that they've
mm-hmm.
done. So that they really didn't go to learn it. They just went to
practice it.
Get in the air on the tongue, or whatever you call it. And just they didn't stay long. Remember? Well, that's the information, the impression I had at the time. The reading I told him Blake about it. We were talking about that. Some of his friends read all the time, but they don't make much of it. And I found that I can't read by myself. I don't need a class, but I can't read by myself. I've got to have somewhere where I can get it out, where I can see it. And also have someone check my readings, my interpretations. So I don't trust my interpretations anymore. I used to be perfectly well satisfied with them. And you see, I sent you that little story, the Camus story. It was a very nice little story, you see. And it seems like it opens up a great deal. And you see, when I say something like this, it sounds as if I'm taking a position against fiction or against literature, but it's not that, because I use it all the time, and I couldn't get along without it. But there's less in it than you think.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's in it, you can't get it out. It's not what Camus knew, but it's what that little vehicle would hold.
Mm-hmm.
And you could read, you could test those things, you see. You don't have to read French to do that, you do it anyways. You could just test it. And of course, another thing you do is talk to some of the writers that you know, and you find out they don't know much. But you can't tell it from their writing. So, the mental life has so many, many traps that, you see, when you are at work with Phoebe, she can check you, and you see you're fortunate.
Mm-hmm. She really read the glass of charge.
Yeah.
And it was totally verbal, too. There was never any, I never read anything about it. I read Henry Adams, but that was the summer afterwards. And, it was all verbal and visual.
They don't let you cook it. Oh,
God. Okay.
I'll leave that there. And, I got it. I didn't realize you could...